Hello, welcome to the Estudos Medievais podcast, a production of the Laboratory of Medieval Studies of the University of São Paulo and the thematic projects A Connected History of the Middle Ages. In today's episode, we have the pleasure of talking with Cormac Ograda to discuss the subject of feminism throughout history. Professor Ograda is Professor Emeritus of Economics at University College Dublin and one of the world's foremost experts on the history of feminism. He's the author of books such as Famine, A Short History, Black 47 and Beyond, The Great Irish Famine in History, Economy and Memory, and Eating People is Wrong, and other essays on famine, its past and its future, all published by Princeton University Press, Ireland, A New Economic History, and Famine Demography, Evidence from the Past and the Present by Oxford University Press, and is one of the editors of Famine in European History by Cambridge University Press, among many other books and articles on the subject. Cormac, thank you very much for accepting our invitation.
Thanks a lot.
Well, the phenomenon of lack of foods can be described by lots of different words. In English, we can talk about famine, hunger, starvation, dearth, each one with a slightly different meaning. So when we talk about this complex phenomena throughout history, what exactly are we talking about, Professor? Is it possible to define this phenomenon?
Yeah, well, there's a sense in which there are both many words for famine with slightly different meanings in different languages. And then there are different definitions as well. You're right. And then there are some languages in which there isn't really a separate word for famine. There's a word that has some relation to starvation or hunger or what have you. But I have my own definition, and I suppose what I want to emphasize is that first, famine is not about individuals starving. It's societal. It's collective. It involves a group or a subgroup within a society. That's one element. The other is that it involves people dying. I think we're talking here about famines that kill, or famines that really might kill, I suppose, if they were allowed to continue further. So that sense that famines are killing events is important. Another thing to remember, I suppose, is that famines are events. So for that reason, they're something that don't last forever. They're not a kind of a steady state that lasts for 10 years or 20 years. And I also wanted to allow for the fact that, in theory anyway, a famine can happen when there is, in some sense, enough food around. But there is this issue of access to food. So the definition I proposed is that a famine involves a shortage of food or of purchasing power. So what that means is that the food might be there, but people don't have the money to acquire it. That leads directly to excess mortality from starvation, or, and this is important, hunger-related diseases, because most deaths from famine are not due to literal starvation. They're due to diseases that are brought on by people's immunity being weakened, or because they are exposed to diseases they might not normally be exposed to. I don't know if that's clear. But no, anyway, that's my definition. And, you know, some people agree, but it's actually, a lot of people tell me that it's reasonable. So it's a working definition.
As you mentioned, the famines are a very complex phenomenon, and it's difficult to determine a single cause for most of them. One of the most influential explanations was that by English economist Thomas Malthus in the end of the 18th century. And what were his hypotheses for the causes of famine?
Well, Malthus was one of the inventors. I suppose a lot of people would consider him as the inventor of population economics, which is about the relationship between economic growth, poverty, and and food supply, that kind of thing. And Malthus was warning, I suppose, his first essay on population was a warning that because the capacity of population to grow was always stronger, greater than the population of the food supply to expand, that these two forces would come into conflict, and that over rapid population growth would result in impoverishment and hunger. And then he said, in extreme cases, famine. So Malthus saw famine as, if you like, a corrective or a remedy to the problem of overpopulation. He wasn't saying famines were necessarily good things, but he thought they were natural events. If the supply of food and the number of people is out of sync, then that cannot continue. And if it does continue, then famines are almost inevitable. Now, that has one implication, which in a way is a bit sinister, and that is that there is something natural about famines, and therefore we should not try to stop them. You know, if a famine happens, then it's somehow like an act of God. It's a corrective mechanism, and if we don't allow nature do its work, then in future there will be worse famines. If we don't allow people to learn the lesson that a famine introduces, then the situation will recur in future, but it will be even more severe. I'm not saying I agree with this view, but I'm saying it is a view that became very much associated with the way Malthus saw this tension between population and food supply being resolved, even temporarily. Now, it's also true that Malthus wasn't always that harsh. He's most famous for his essay on population, which was first published in 1798. And that was a kind of an anti-utopian treatise. It was a kind of a reality check treatise that, you know, perfectibility is something that's not around the corner, and hardship and poverty is around the corner if we don't try to control population growth in some way. But at the same time, he published a pamphlet in 1801 called An Essay on the High Cost of Provisions. And that was in the wake of not so much a famine, but a threatened famine in England in 1799-1800. And Malthus admitted there that public policy, which of a kind that in normal times he would not approve of, saved lives. He was referring to what historians know as the old poor law of England, which was a means of relieving the poor at the parish level. If they're poor, they're unemployed, then there is an entitlement to subsistence. And he argued that this old poor law was responsible for saving lives. And he didn't say that was wrong. He kind of said, well, look, they did this, and even though I wouldn't normally approve, I think the fact that lives were saved was a good thing. So there is a little bit of tension between, on the one hand, the more dogmatic Malthusian Malthus, if you like, and the softer Malthus, who is actually lesser known, but he's nevertheless there. Now, the softer Malthus, of course, brings us to another interpretation of why famines happen and how famines can be alleviated. And that is by focusing not on natural processes or physical laws of, you know, how population expands or how food supply expands, but on what we would call human agency, on human action. And like one extreme example would be that wars cause famines. And you can have a famine during wartime, and not because food is scarce, although war can make food scarce, but because people can't get access to food. because it's impossible for people to move, it's impossible for people to buy or to sell, and what have you. So you get wars, if you like, causing famines, and that is something that is technically separate from a harvest failure. It's a different explanation, and it's caused by human action. And you could also say that human action can alleviate a famine. You know, you could say that there's a harvest failure, and unless the government does nothing, there will be a famine. But maybe the government can do something about it by borrowing, by providing free food to people. And, you know, typically governments try to do that kind of thing. So there is this element of human agency, which, of course, is more important in the 19th and 20th century than it was back in the 14th and the 15th century. But it's always there to some extent. You know, the state in the past, rulers get some of their legitimacy from population who don't have the right to vote for them, but they get some legitimacy by the sense that if there is a crisis, the elite, the ruler, will try and help the poor. And if the ruler does that, he gets popular. If he doesn't, people will resent it and people will remember it. And, you know, in history, there are rulers who are remembered as saving people from starvation, and there are those who are remembered for doing nothing when there was the risk of starvation. So that is another dimension which is historically important, but which is separate from the Malthusian view. Mm-hmm. I should also, this brings us up, I suppose, to the famous work of Amartya Sen, the Bengali economist. Bengal is a province in India, where Sen spent his youth. There was a famine there during World War II in 1943, which Sen witnessed. He didn't really suffer from it. He was from a well-off family. But he remembers seeing poor people, and he remembers members of his family trying to help them and so on. Now, Sen was convinced that this famine happened even though, strictly speaking, there wasn't a shortage of food. And he argued that wartime conditions turned a situation of food adequacy into one where people couldn't get access to that food. Now, there were different reasons why that might happen. One might be that the government would keep a lot of the food for military purposes, which would normally go to poor people. But then there was also the reason that markets do not work very well during a crisis like in Bengal, so that people speculate in food. They hold back food supplies. Now, this might be farmers holding back supplies. It could be traders. More likely, it's traders, millers, and people like that. So Sen believed that the issue was not so much that there wasn't enough food in the physical sense, but that speculation increased the price of food artificially so that people lacked the purchasing power to buy enough food to keep them alive. So this was what Sen caused an entitlement crisis. In other words, people's income no longer entitled them to the amount of food they needed to live on. And that is distinct from what he calls a food availability deficit crisis, you know, a classic Malthusian crisis where the problem is harvest failure. And these are distinct. So in a way, the Malthusian one is, if you think in terms of the cake or the loaf of bread, it gets smaller, so there isn't enough for everybody anymore. In the view of Amartya Sen, the loaf of bread remains the same, but it's divided up in a way that the poor cannot enough get enough to live. And a lot of it is held in barns and warehouses and in fields and so on. So people starve as a result. And that is an entitlement crisis.
Well, that was a perfect review on the historiography of causes of famine. So now, speaking of some historical famines, how common were they in the past, specifically on the pre-modern or pre-industrial societies? How often do these famines that you define as the moments, famines that causes death among the population, how common were they?
Right. Now, there are one way of thinking about this is, what evidence is there in the past? You know, and I don't mean the recent past, but in, say, hundreds of years ago, how common were famines? And the answer is that the evidence is confusing sometimes and lacking in others. And the evidence doesn't always distinguish between a local famine, which lasts a few months, and a national famine, which might last a year or two. So you have to worry about that a little bit. There are, where statistics are lacking, there are chronological sources. There are some written sources. And these are helpful, but I think sometimes, again, they are confusing and they don't give you all the information you want. So they might, for example, say, there was a severe shortage of food and prices doubled. But they don't tell you how long prices remained double what they had been. Did they go up for a week or two, or was it for 6 months? If it's only for a week or two, that's not going to cause a famine. But if it's for many months, it will. You could also fry and infer how frequent famines are from price data, if they're available. And what they suggest is that famines are not, they don't happen every second year, every third year. You're talking about maybe every 10 or 15 years, something like that. If they happen more often and they were big, population would disappear. Population would not be able to restore itself. So they can't be happening all the time. So probably our best guess is that in the past, in very poor countries, famines might, you know, famines by the definition we talked about at the beginning might happen once every 10 years. And part of the reason why they don't happen more often is that people expect them, people worry about them, and they take some precautionary action. And what that means is that sometimes when there is a food shortage, people can cope with it. I am inclined to argue that for a famine to be serious, you have to have what I call back-to-back harvest failures, 2 years in succession. One-off failures, people somehow learn to cope with through borrowing, through having stored some food, through maybe trading down to foods that normally would be considered food for animals, but they'd say, look, I'm really hungry, so I'm going to have to humiliate myself and eat what normally animals would eat, you know. So that that kind of possibility. Now, that will work maybe if the harvest failure is just a once-off failure. Charity works too. You know, people have pity on other people and they say, okay, look, this will pass. So I will help. And then the next time I will be short and somebody else will help me. So there is a form of charity, can be a form of insurance. You know, it can be a good deed, but it can also be on the understanding, I'm helping you now, you help me in future when I need help, you know. So society, poor societies develop these kind of mechanisms to protect themselves. But those mechanisms don't work as well if you have two or three harvest failures in a row. And then you're in real, real trouble and you're going to have a famine and people will die.
So thinking about the deaths during famine periods, from this period when they stop being just a bad harvest or a period of scarcity and they become a catastrophic famine. Karl Marx said famously that the Irish famine killed poor devils only. And yes. How correct was his assessments, not only about the Irish famine, but famines in general? Who usually were the most affected by these periods?
Well, I mean, this is broadly speaking true. It's undoubtedly the case that propertyless people are most vulnerable. People who have no savings, people who don't own land, people who rely on their own labor. Or else, you know, people who are elderly and rely on charity of people who work. These are the most vulnerable people. So during famines, typically when famines start, the first victims are very often poor people on the move, people who can't find food where they live and they normally work. So they move somewhere else in the hope of getting relief or getting work. And they are very often the most visible early victims. But the weak are vulnerable, and that means the very young, the very old. And another generalization we can say, and that has been much discussed, is that males are more vulnerable than females. I'm not saying this is always universally true, but I think it's true 9 times out of 10 or 19 times out of 20. And there are physiological reasons for this. And that is that females are more resilient. And this has to do with males requiring more energy for physiological reasons to survive. Females have more body fat that they can fall back on when they're hungry, so they last longer. Now, having said that, you can push that only to a certain degree, because what kills people mainly during famines until very recently and in exceptional circumstances is famine diseases. And those famine diseases can kill rich people as well as poor people. So we know, for instance, during the Great Irish Famine of the 1840s, or indeed there was another big famine in Ireland in 1740-41. And it's well documented that a lot of, in the 18th century, a lot of rich people, members of the elite, died. During the Great Famine of the 1840s, which is better documented, we know that people who were in contact with the poor or lived near the poor, such as clergy who ministered to the poor, medical people who ministered to the poor, people who worked in poorhouses, again, who are in close proximity with the poor, died. Now, these people did not die of starvation. Most of them died of typhus. They died of infectious diseases, which the poor transmit. And famine conditions give rise to conditions in which there is a lot of dirt, a lot of people not changing their clothes, of not washing. And this provides a fertile field for the lice that carry the bacteria that cause typhus. And the rich are not immune. And in fact, it is sometimes argued that the rich are, to some extent, more vulnerable if they get typhus than the poor, because the poor have somehow built up some immunity to typhus in non-famine situations. So if they catch typhus, they may actually survive it. But having said that, typhus is a big killer during famines. It's also true that diseases like malaria and cholera, who normally kill the poor, they also kill more of the poor during famines. So the answer is that Marx is, broadly speaking, right. It's the poor who suffer most, but others can also suffer. Now, it should also be pointed out that in the 20th century, we know better what's causing the typhus. And we know that keeping clean, changing clothes, and so on protects against typhus. So, for instance, during World War I, on the Western Front, soldiers were forever being put through cold baths and their clothes were being changed and so on, with the result that very few soldiers die of typhus, which would not have been the case 100 years earlier. And that is because there is a medical knowledge which prevents typhus. Now, that does not mean that there is a cure for typhus. Once you catch the typhus, you're still vulnerable. But people learned that by, you know, giving people showers, washing them, cutting their hair so that the lice cannot settle in their hair and so on. And that is why typically in modern armies, soldiers get their hair cut all the time. So, and this is less true on the Eastern Front. Typhus still does a lot of killing during World War I. By World War II, that is no longer the case. So there is this accumulated medical knowledge which is having an effect. And then there are famines during World War II in which when people die, they nearly all die of either literal starvation or else of kind of, I suppose you would call it a kind of a poisoning associated with dysentery. You know, people eating the wrong kind of food and getting sick and not being able to retain liquids and in that way dying, you know. So I can give you, there are two very well-known examples of this. One is the Dutch hunger winter of 1944-45. There is a famine, it's a very small famine, but nevertheless it's intense. About 15 or 20,000 people die. They nearly all die of literal starvation. They die of muscular failure, you know, just they fall over and then and they have huge weight loss and they die. The same is true, broadly speaking, during the siege of Leningrad, which is at its most intense in 1941-42. About 1 million people die in that period and in the months after, up to 43. Most of those die again of literal starvation or of dysentery, of that kind of cause. Now, at the same time, there is a famine in Bengal, which we talked about, the Amartya Sen famine. That is well documented as well. About 2 million more people died. Most of those die of disease, not of literal starvation. And that is because the context is very different. It's an extremely poor area, so the people die of typhus, of cholera, of malaria, you know. So the context differs. If there were a famine today in Brazil or in Ireland, for some reason, people would die mainly of literal starvation, because by now we have a cure. We can deal with typhus, we can deal with dysentery. There are ways of treating these things medically if you have them, but we may not be able to solve the starvation problem if there isn't enough food.
Besides the direct deaths caused by starvation or diseases, what are some of the other consequences of famines? How do they affect societies?
Sure. Like I could talk here about another consequence of famine, which I suppose has been emphasized since research on the Dutch hunger winter. And the idea is that if you are born during a famine, or if you are in the womb during a famine, then this affects your health in adulthood. So this is using, you know, this. So the idea is that there is an insult, a shock to the fetus, when the fetus grows up, it is more likely to subject from certain conditions. Now, does this mean that people die sooner? There is less evidence for that than that they will catch schizophrenia, they will become schizophrenic, or that they will become diabetic, that they will suffer from what is known as type 2 diabetes, and therefore become overweight and so on. So there is a good evidence that famines have this kind of consequence. So in other words, famines cause damage long after they are over, in a way that was not understood before. But I have to say too, that the demographic consequences are very, very minor. So I reckon that if you take the Dutch Ingle winter, which killed about 15,000 people, how many extra cases of schizophrenia did it cause? My reckoning is probably less than 100. And one reason for that is that the famine reduced the birth rate. So a lot of people who would have become schizophrenic in normal times weren't born, right? So they're not alive in the first place to become schizophrenic. So that reduces the power of the famine to cause schizophrenia in the population. And when you net that out, the demographic impact is there, but it's so small to be almost invisible, you know. And this lesson has not been fully understood by people in the media. You know, there are lots of media reports. The Dutch hunger winter, the Great Leap famine in China, show that hundreds of thousands, millions of people would suffer from schizophrenia as a result of famine. It's not true. But nevertheless, you can make a point. You can make a medical point about the connection. Now, there is also, I think, one might say, a more plausible, a more important consequence, and that is that people who survive are traumatized somehow. You know, this again is a common claim, and it depends. It depends on how you see trauma, really. Is trauma something that marks people for life, which is a more Freudian interpretation? Or are people resilient so that they are traumatized, but they learn how to cope? People are resilient. So there is trauma, but the trauma in the case of most people doesn't last forever. You know, there is literature which suggests that 90% of people recover from a shock like a famine. There is temporary hurt, but it's in your DNA, if you like, to recover. I suppose one could also think beyond demographics, what are the economic consequences of a big famine? And there, you have to remember that famines kill people, but they do not change the capacity of the land to bear crops. So you can have a bad harvest, but the following harvest can be perfectly normal or good, you know. And you can also say that the famine doesn't mean that buildings are destroyed or factories are destroyed. So everything is the same once the famine is over, except there are fewer people. And you would then argue as an economist that this probably means the survivors are going to be better off. Wages are going to be higher. Profits are probably going to be lower because businessmen have to pay more to workers in order to employ them. And so that is the common way of looking at the implication of a famine for an economy. So in terms of how the economy adjusts after the famine. So there is a kind of a golden age for survivors, for most people after a famine. But I can think of cases where that is not so. For instance, if you have a famine in a country like, let's say, Iceland, where there are no crops, there is no grain. So people live on livestock. They make butter, they make yogurt, they drink milk, they eat fish. And the cattle are affected by some disease. And people die because they don't have the food. The difference is here is that it's not going to be you're going to have the same number of cattle the following year, like you're going to have a normal wheat crop. Once the capital stock is affected, it takes a longer period for the capital stock to recover, and people can suffer for several years. You know, so it depends on whether the food supply is a mainly animal one or a mainly vegetable one, and that can make a difference. Another, like this again, in the Irish case, the famine is not just a crop failure, it's an ecological disaster. So it was caused by a fungus, and the fungus did not go away. The fungus is still there. You know, now we know a way of dealing with it. You can spray the crop and you can, you know, disinfect the crops from the fungus. But in Ireland after the famine, potato yields continued to be low long after the famine was over. And that means, in a way, the land was less productive. You know, it couldn't produce as many potatoes as before. And that meant that living standards were compromised, and that it gave people an incentive to leave, to emigrate, because the land was not capable of feeding as many people as before. Yeah, so these are different possibilities, you know, of how famine affects people in the short run and in the long run. And I suppose one argument that is now in the air, which wasn't there before, is this fetal origins argument. And I think actually it's not very important. It's interesting scientifically, but in the context of famines, it's not very important, you know.
Well, one of the great taboos surrounding the famines is what you've called before famine's dark secrets, survival cannibalism. And what are the evidences for cases of survival cannibalism in past famines?
I think there are two answers. I suppose one is that it's easy to get evidence for famine cannibalism. But that does not mean that it was universal or very common. You know, I remember talking to historians 10 or 15 years ago, and they believed that talk about famine cannibalism was really a way of trying to convince people that a famine was very serious. So they would say, oh, they're eating each other. But it wasn't literally true. So it was like a trope or a motif that people used to maybe look for help, to say this is a really serious situation. And I suppose in the case of the Irish famine, which I started to work with when the Irish famine, and I was skeptical of claims that there was cannibalism during the famine. But then I came across several examples. Now, when I say several, you're talking about maybe a dozen, a few dozen people. It's not like it was universal, but it was there. Mm-hmm. And there are other famines where the evidence is much more common. And during World War II, for example, there was a lot of cannibalism, I think, in Leningrad. And perhaps in other parts, there was a famine in Moldova just after World War II. And in a way, you can link that famine to World War II, because this is in 1946. So the food situation in Moldova at that time is still a consequence of World War II. And there was a lot of examples of famine cannibalism. There was famine cannibalism in Ukraine during the famine in 1932-33. Again, there is evidence for famine in the Soviet Union in 1921-22. And you go back in history. Now, there are some cases of famines where the evidence is absent or lacking. And then you might want to ask, maybe as an anthropologist, are there certain taboos which are more powerful in some societies than in others? So that in India, for example, there is far less convincing evidence for famine cannibalism, you know, than in, say, China in the 1950s. And one could say that this is because of the really strong taboo against eating beef or eating any foods that might be suspected of being from cattle, or indeed eating any meat at all in Hinduism. And it is said that Muslims in Bengal were, much less reluctant to eat beef than Hindus were, and that this may explain why Hindus were more likely to suffer than Muslims. In fact, the reality is that Muslims probably suffered more during the famine in Bengal because they were poorer than the Hindus. But yeah, I mean, there is, and then it's a very, very, it's still a very, very emotive topic, famine cannibalism. So on the one hand, if you take the famine in Ukraine in 1932-1933, there is on the one hand a discourse which highlights famine cannibalism because it wants to, if you like, blame the authorities. And a way of blaming the authorities is to say they were responsible for making people eat each other. That is, and during the famine of 1921-1922, Lenin and the Bolsheviks highlighted famine cannibalism, and they blamed it on capitalism. You know, so you can blame it on the Ukraine, and you blame it on the Russians, or you blame it on capitalism or whatever. But at individual level, you want to hide it. And you certainly do not want to say my grandmother was a cannibalism or my granduncle killed people in order to survive. So you will deny it happened. So at one level, at the macro level, yes, it happened. At the micro level, it's something that is extremely embarrassing and that you will try to hide. But we do have individual level evidence of people who are executed for it, of people who were sent to prison for it, and so on. So it is a difficult issue. And so I think maybe there are gradations, because you can have people trying to survive on the corpses of people who have already died. That's one kind of cannibalism, not survivor cannibalism. Or you can have people killing babies in order to consume the meat, you know. And that is a murder cannibalism. And very few societies actually, you know, tolerate that. Or it's and we know that in Leningrad, if people were caught by the authorities and suspected of guilt, of even trying to kill people, they were shot on sight immediately, you know, whereas there was more understanding for people trying to live on the basis of, you know, eating corpses. And like, we know in Latin America, the famous case of the flight in the Andes, when a lot of people found themselves in a situation where they were going to die. And there were some who were prepared to eat parts of the bodies of the survivors, and others said, no, we can't do it. And those then at the beginning, what happened in that case is that those who were prepared to do it gave some other food to those who said, no, we can't do that. But in the end, I think everybody was trying to survive on as like cannibals, you know, until they got, and that is what kept them alive. So, you know, in that case, it was almost like in extremis, everybody was prepared to do it. And, you know, there are these gruesome topics that are probably worth, for anthropologists, worth more study. I mean, this is not for me. And it's something that in a way one doesn't like talking about so much, but you have to know. And I always tell students, well, I used to, because I don't teach anymore, I've now retired, but I used to tell them, if you don't understand that cannibalism can happen during famines, you don't know what a famine is. You don't realize how bad and what famines do to people, you know, because famines make people behave in terrible ways. You know, they lose compassion. They become very self-centered. They steal from each other. They kill each other, you know, and they become prostitutes. They become concubines, you know. So famine does terrible things to people. And famine cannibalism is the worst, probably, of these things that they do to each other.
You've mentioned some strategies of famine relief earlier when you talked about charities. And what are some of these different kinds of strategies to cope with famines, be it by private or public private or public actors, and how effective are these strategies?
Well, they are rarely fully effective, you know. One would have to regard it as a corrective, but it is one that happens only in the early stages of famine, and maybe when the food availability situation is not absolutely disastrous, and that is protest and rioting. And this is a common form of redress. You know, we used to think maybe that this is something that was relatively recent, and it is a reaction that is associated very much with the English social historian E.P. Thompson, who is a left-wing great historian, and he describes this in England, and he refers to the moral economy of the crowd, and the crowd has a sense of what is just and what is fair, and its sense of fairness is not consistent with rich people continuing to live as normal when the majority is starving. So they starve, they, instead of starving, they riot and they loot and so on. And Thompson argues that this is sometimes successful and that it is a rational strategy. And for the poor, it is actually a rational strategy, because what happens is sometimes the authorities deal with it very harshly and they hang 10 or 20 people, and they say, and this intimidates the others and the rioting stops. But it's also quite common for the authorities to say, we must do something. And they bring in controls on bakeries and they say, you can no longer make cakes. Now you must make only bread. and the bread must be brown bread, not white bread, and you cannot charge more than this, and so on. And that has an effect, you know, and it is the effect of the moral economy response. And there is evidence from all over the place that these can work as a temporary remedy. But if the food shortage is deep and genuine, this will not work. And eventually the crowd will realize that it is not working. And then this is when hope and anger gives way to despair. And then you are moving from a situation where there is a food scarcity to where there is a real textbook famine. So in that situation, the moral economy response switches from being helpful to being no longer able to succeed. There are, of course, lots of other responses at the individual level, and we talked a little bit about them. Because famines recur, there is, if you like, in poor societies, a kind of social capital, a memory, which involves people knowing how to convert certain plants into food. They don't normally do this because this is not very tasty. It takes a lot of time and so on. But they learn to distinguish between foods which are safe and foods which are poisonous, even though they don't use them very much. And when the crisis happens, they say, oh, nettles are okay, you know. We can boil them. If we can get heat water, we can boil nettles and make soup. And there's iron in nettles, and it helps. Then people also learn to trade down. So they move from wheat to rye, or they might move from rye to potatoes. And this, of course, works in particular when people plant two or three crops at the same time. And so when new crops are introduced, you can see that for a while, famines become less common. And that is true in Ireland. You know, as the potato spread, the poor were safer until this blight I talked about earlier, which is like an ecological disaster. It's not something people could have expected. You know, it's like AIDS hitting potatoes. You know, something that you don't expect and which you don't know how to deal with. There is nothing you can do. But in a situation that is not like that, people can trade down from one food to the other. You know, people who ate some meat and said, oh, we will export the meat. We won't eat it anymore, you know. And then people also, they will try, say, fishing. They will try to rely on fishing, very often illegally, because the fish are not common property if they're in rivers. They belong to the rich, typically. But the poor will try and get access to food in that way. The sea is also a possibility, but it really doesn't work very well because in poor areas, if they have access to the sea, and if the sea is rough, that is no good. They do not have ways of storing fish, and fish are very perishable. So it's a partial remedy. Migration is always associated with famine. People move, and the women might move in one way and the men in another. People deal with scarcity by postponing marriage, by not having children. Now, sometimes this is not voluntary. Sometimes it's because of women becoming incapable of having children. But that also is, if you like, a mechanism which lessens the impact of the famine. So instead of having children who are going to die, the women don't have the children, you know. So in a way, it's a kind of a coping mechanism. And so there are also, even in very poor societies, you have moneylenders. And these are people who maybe are disliked because it seems like, you know, they thrive in a situation where everybody is starving. Now, it's not as simple as that, because the people who want to borrow are bad risks. It's not clear that they would be able to pay back. And for that reason, interest rates are very high. And the reason the interest rates are very high is because a lot of the people who have borrowed die and never pay back. So those who do pay back, of course, have to pay back for those who have died. It's like, you know, it's kind of an insurance mechanism. And so these moneylenders are unpopular. And then there are also those people who buy land from poor people. And there is a sense in which they do well because they buy the land cheap, but and the poor are forced to sell the land cheap at bargain basement prices. But again, it is a way of surviving. The poor, we mentioned this before, they might have had a cow or a few pigs or some hens. So the first line of defense is you kill the hens and you kill the pig. And you might sell the meat, or you might try and live on some of it, you know. So there are, you know, there's a whole range of, and then you think of putting all these together. And that is why I say, if the harvest failure is just a once-off harvest failure, people may survive. It's only when it's more than 1 year, and it's very, very big, you know, when there's total crop failure, that you get a famine.
Okay, one last question before we go to our conclusions. What happens after famines? How do the individuals and communities bounce back after these periods of starvation and death?
Well, there is a bit of a literature about this too. And there is, on the one hand, the economics literature I mentioned earlier, which is about the majority of survivors being somewhat better off, you know, and like they bear the scars. A lot of their families would have died or emigrated or whatever. So that is also the traumatic aspect I talk about. But it is true that in the wake of famines, usually the survivors are somewhat better off than they were before the famine. You know, again, this how big this effect is depends on how big the famine was. For most famines, you might say it's not very noticeable, because famines that kill more than 3 or 5% of the population, they're less common. You know, famines that kill 10 or 15% of the population, these are very unusual. Famines typically don't kill as many. So therefore, the adjustment isn't going to be as dramatic. But that is a generalization. And then you could also say that famines breed certain resentments which last. You know, you might be a survivor and there is some moneylender and you say, you stole my land, you bought my land when it was cheap, I had collateral and here I am, you know, and I want my land back or whatever, you know. And there might also be resentments because people did nasty things to each other during a famine. They stole from each other. And again, you know, it's possible that there are these clashes that are eventually forgotten about, but they may last a generation or two. I mean, they certainly do not last 5 generations, even though there is a kind of a strain in cultural history, which says that in our subconscious, we remember these things, you know, many generations. I'm skeptical about that, but I'm prepared to learn that if I'm wrong, fine. But my sense is that maybe in a generation or two, there are these resentments, but that eventually, maybe there is some kind of invented memory. Maybe some historian tells us we should remember, and then we think we remember. But and there's an element of that in Ireland, I think. You know, we're talking about a great famine that now happened 180 years ago, and where most of the victims spoke a language which most people today don't speak anymore. So it's very distant culturally, economically, chronologically, and how it could still have a big cultural impact on us, I'm not so sure.
Right. Now, as a conclusion, you wrote in A Famine, A Short History, you said that writing about famine today is part of the process of making it less likely in the future. So I'd like to end this episode by asking you, how does the study of ancient famines can help us better understand and help us to prevent them from happening again in the future and in the present as well?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing that we have learned about famines from studying the past is that when there is a need to help the poor, it's not just how much you help them with, how much food you provide. It's how quick the response is. That is very, very important. The speed of response. And therefore, you need to be on the lookout for warning signals. And history provides us with some warning signals. One is if people start to migrate, if people start leaving their homes in big numbers, there is something afoot. You can also tell it from price signals. You know, if prices start to go up and stay up, then typically that's because it's not so much because of speculation, it can be, but it's because there is a threat of scarcity. And so, you know, there are these things. The other thing, you want to allow information to flow as freely as possible. You want societies to be as open as possible. It's possible to hide information about famine. And that was the case in China in 1969 to 1961. There were historians who denied there had been a famine in China well after the Great Famine. There was a famine, or there was something going on in North Korea in the 1990s. But some people maybe exaggerated what was going on for Cold War reasons. The regime denied that there was anything going on for their own reasons. And in between, experts didn't really know. So what you want is for information to flow. You want people inside to spread the news. You want whistleblowers. You want to use espionage, whatever way of finding out, is there a famine or is there not? That is very important. You want peace. You don't want wars. Famines are much more likely if there's a war. So you want to do everything short of, you know, appeasing very, very nasty dictators. You want to stop wars happening. You want to provide every assistance to international law that prevents wars from happening. You want to provide facilities for people to negotiate without shame and so on. This is extremely important. Pressure has to be put on people who are threatening warfare. Because in the 20th century, most famines have been associated with war. There are some exceptions, like the Great Leap Famine in China. But World War I and World War II were associated with many, many famines. Many famines. Most famines in sub-Saharan Africa in recent decades have been associated with civil wars. So if you can stop the wars, you are halfway to stopping the famines. There are very, very few peacetime famines today. And I think for the next few decades, that will still be the case. Now, if you want to go further into the future, global warming may result in famines in peacetime. I'm not sure. That could be the case. But I suppose in the meantime, we have to plan against famines the next decade or two. And I would say war, the threat of war, and the threat of closed societies who try and hide the truth, they are the greatest risks of famine. So you also, I suppose, want more broadly to encourage slower population growth in countries where population is still growing very fast. Now, this is becoming less of an issue. I mean, in China, a generation ago, people were really worried about population growth. Now in China, the worry is about the threat of population decline. And at a global level, population growth is much less of a threat than it was. It's still a big threat in a place like Afghanistan, Pakistan, parts of India. And there, you would like maybe providing people with incentives to have smaller families, maybe making them worry less about old age, providing old age security networks. One of the reasons why people have big families is they want security against old age when they can no longer work themselves. So one can think of things like that. One can also think of not stopping non-governmental agencies from helping, you know, encouraging philanthropy, encouraging charities to help when there are emergencies. And they're good at that, you know, that you want to do that, but not to the extent that you will disincentivize producers from producing food. You know, if poor people think they will always get food regardless, then they may say, what's the point in growing crops? So you don't want it to go that far, but you want it to be clear that if there is an emergency, there will be food available. And it may not be the food you would like most, but it will prevent you from starving. So there are these things one can do, and history, I think, has taught us that these things matter and can matter in the future. So, like, on that mildly optimistic note, I would say, there we go.
For our listeners that want to delve deeper on the subject of past famines, what are some recommendations that you can give them for reading, listening, whatever you can think of?
Well, at the risk of blowing my own trumpet, I wrote a short book on famine that is now something like 12 or 13 years old, but it's still in print, and it's called Famine, A Short History. And it's a kind of a fairly easy introduction to the subject, and it's more or less up to date. But again, there is a great deal of information available online on famines. One doesn't have to search very far. And there are lots of histories of individual famines that are very accessible. There's a lot of work being done on the Bengal famine. There is a new, very excellent history out on a famine in Finland, which is the last real peacetime famine in Europe. There is an excellent book out on the hunger winter in Holland by Ingrid Zwarte. There are many books on the siege famine in Leningrad, and some of those are excellent. Some of them are more technical than others. But and actually, that scenario is the kind of scenario I suppose we should be studying most, because if famines are going to occur, it's in these wartime circumstances, and those famines are for that reason particularly interesting to study.
Professor, thank you very much for coming, for your great interview, and thank you very much.
Not at all. Okay, thanks a lot. Bye.